Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Sheckman. There's so much talk about trade and trade deals in this election cycle that it's almost painful. Some might want to cover their ears or just tune out another recitation about NAFTA or TPP or jobs that may or may not have been lost. However, there is a single issue buried deep inside the often superficial discussion, one that's worth sitting up and taking notice. That is the legal underpinnings of many of these deals, the mechanism by which corporations often have more power than sovereign states, including the U.S., and the structure by which a shadowy scheme of trade courts, known as the Investor-State Dispute Settlement Tribunals, represent a major shift in global power, away from governments and towards corporations. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, journalist Haley Sweetland Edwards. Haley Sweetland Edwards is a national correspondent. She previously was an editor at the Washington Monthly. She's lived and worked in the Middle East and the former Soviet Union. She's written for such publications as The Atlantic, The New Republic, Foreign Policy. She studied philosophy at Yale and journalism at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. And it is my pleasure to welcome Haley Sweetland Edwards to talk about shadow courts, the tribunals that rule global trade. Haley, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Who, What, Why.
Thank you so much for having me.
This idea of these investor state dispute settlement tribunals, this was something that was originated back in the 1950s, had a very different reason for being then. Talk a little bit about its origin.
Right. This Europeans and Americans started discussing this back in the wake of World War II. The idea was to protect European and American investors, corporations that were sort of beginning to build oil fields and factories in the developing world, and sort of the beginning wave of what would become globalization as we know it today. And at that time, the world was just a very different place. You had a lot of nationalist leaders coming to power, a lot of communist regimes rising up around the world, and you had expropriation was a major problem, where governments would just come in and take over oil fields or take over factories, and that would be it. The investors would be out of luck. So this tribunal system came of age during that period, and the idea was to protect foreign investors, to protect their property in foreign countries, so they didn't have to use those countries' court systems.
Why did this scheme evolve separate and apart from the fundamental dispute resolution mechanism through the World Trade Organization, the way it worked with respect to nations suing nations?
That's a really important point. These are two parallel tracks. When we talk about these investor state dispute settlement tribunals, we're really talking about investment. We're talking about private property, corporations and private investors. On the other side of this is trade as we know it, as we think of it. And that's the World Trade Organization, the dispute settlement body. And in all of that area, it is sovereign nations versus sovereign nations. So at the World Trade Organization, you can only ever have, say, the government of Canada going against the government of the United States. Over here in these shadow courts, in these investor state dispute settlement courts, you actually have private corporations going against sovereign nations. You might have a corporation in Canada using this binding arbitration to challenge the sovereign nation of the United States.
When did this really start to gear up? When did it begin? When were the first lawsuits brought by corporations within the framework of ISDS?
The first challenges were in the late 60s and early 70s. This provision started appearing in trade agreements, in bilateral investment treaties in the late 50s. And then you just saw this slow ratcheting up. There weren't very many cases. There were an occasional challenge, maybe one a year, one every few years from about 1960 up till the mid-1990s. And then all of a sudden we saw an explosion. We saw in the last 15 years there have been about 650 claims. In the entire time that this mechanism existed before then, there were about 50 claims total.
How much of that grows out of all the things that we have tried to add on to trade agreements in the areas of environment, human rights, copyright protection? As the agreements themselves have become more complex, has it set the stage for more disputes under this mechanism?
Those two things are actually kind of unrelated. These trade agreements have gotten enormously complicated. They're no longer about tariffs and quotas in a way that they were 40 years ago. Now they're about, you know, the trafficking of exotic animals and the trafficking of humans and labor laws and all kinds of things, that intellectual property that wouldn't have existed in trade agreements even 30 years ago, 25 years ago. So we have seen those change a lot. But again, that's all in one category, and all of those disputes go under the World Trade Organization's dispute settlement body. This mechanism, this investor-state dispute settlement, is again its own thing, and that's where just corporations are challenging sovereign nations for their property rights.
What about in situations where private investors' interests are directly impacted by some of these other issues, and Keystone, which you talk about, and the lawsuit from TransCanada, and I'd like you to expand on that, but that arguably is impacted by the environmental issues that surround it as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. So in that case, you have TransCanada, which is the company that would have built the Keystone XL pipeline in the United States. They made certain investments in figuring out where that pipeline would go and lobbying the government to have it built, things like that. So they laid down investment, basically. And when President Obama decided last November to cancel that project, to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline, 3 months later, TransCanada, again, a private Canadian company, used this mechanism, investor-state dispute settlement, to under NAFTA, to demand a binding arbitration with the United States government, saying, and we don't know exactly what the grounds of those of the dispute is yet. It hasn't been made public. But in the past, these cases have been brought on the grounds of lost future profits. So TransCanada could say President Obama's decision essentially expropriated our future profits.
How transparent is this process of dispute resolution?
Not very. It's getting more so. For years and years, you didn't even have to disclose that a dispute was occurring. So I mentioned before there have been more than 700 claims. Those are the 700 claims that we know about. And that's an important caveat because there could have been twice that many, three times as many. We have no idea. In almost every bilateral investment treaty and free trade agreement up until really the early 2000s, maybe 10 years ago, even the mere fact that these disputes were occurring was private, was behind closed doors, no obligation to make them public. Beginning in about 2004, there have been transparency measures injected into them, and they've gotten more transparent as time has gone on. But a lot of these existing bilateral investment treaties are still on the books, totally untransparent.
Where do these courts, these tribunals reside, and who are the players? Where do the players emerge from that are the arbitrators, that are the judges in these situations?
The best way to understand this is to think about it in terms of corporate arbitration. So in those cases, two private companies would determine that they would have binding arbitration in case of a dispute. In those cases, each party appoints an arbitrator, and then they agree on a third, and they meet wherever. You know, they'll meet in a boardroom, they'll meet in a private building, in a rented room, and they'll determine the outcome of these two private corporations' dispute. And that is exactly, more or less, how investor-state dispute settlement works, except for the profound difference is that we're not dealing with two private companies. We're dealing with one sovereign nation and one private company. And this is an extraordinary point because it's really the only mechanism that exists on the international stage that has anything even remotely similar to that. And John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, pointed this out in a recent decision from 2014. He just pointed out that this is really extraordinary, that we don't have, it's unprecedented, and the fact that we would allow a binding arbitration, that we as a our government would submit to binding arbitration with a private company, is unprecedented.
Why has this been allowed to continue to be a part of these international trade agreements? I mean, clearly this has been, as we've talked about, been going on a long time. And even in something like TPP, the most current, the most modern of all the trade agreements, it's still part of it.
Right. So this is actually a great discussion that's happening in D.C. right now. You have so much opposition to this coming from both sides of the ideological spectrum. You have the Tea Party groups who are very suspicious of these tribunals because they are an imposition on U.S. sovereignty. You have the libertarian free market folks at Cato Institute and elsewhere who are worried about it for different reasons. I mean, they see it as a basically taxpayer subsidy for outsourcing. And then you have people on the left. You have Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders who are deeply concerned about it because it allows foreign corporations to challenge public regulations here in the United States. And then the last sort of corner of this is you have more establishment Democrats like Tim Kaine who have also expressed concern about what this does. So the question, of course, is what you said. Why do we still have this thing? And I think that some explanation for it is that it's still really new. I mean, as I said, it for the first 50 years of its existence, it was basically never used. It was a curiosity on the international legal stage, if anything. And suddenly in the 1990s, late 1990s, early 2000s, you've seen this explosion of new cases. People are just beginning to wrap their minds around the possibility that these tribunals have. And it's so complicated and so hard to pass a multilateral investment treaty like TPP that there's this very real sense of let's not rock the boat. Let's not take out anything that has existed in previous treaties, and let's not put in anything new. And I think that's part of it.
Talk about it, though, from an international perspective, because while we talk about the imposition on U.S. sovereignty, this is also something that affects the sovereignty of other nations that are part of trade agreements and other countries, be they Argentina or other nations in around the world, have been sued under this agreement by corporations. Talk about that part of it.
This is a fascinating time to be studying this issue because we are seeing this backlash, not only from the Ecuadors and the Argentinas and countries that have had problems with their judicial systems and with the way that they are treating foreign investors on their soil, but also from countries like Australia, where we have a robust democracy with a complex regulatory system. Just about a few years ago, they passed a public health law that was designed to restrict smoking in the country. And Philip Morris, the massive tobacco company, used this mechanism, investor-state dispute settlement, through a bilateral investment treaty that Australia had with Hong Kong, used this mechanism to challenge that public health law. And Philip Morris's argument was by restricting consumers' access basically to tobacco advertising and the packaging on cigarette boxes and things, that regulation was expropriating the intellectual property of Philip Morris. And you see cases like that, and that one actually, the tribunal ended up deciding in favor of the government. But it's cases like that that you see happening all over the world, cropping up here and there, and there are these extraordinary gray areas where suddenly, just recently in another case that I talk about, there was Chevron was... There was a long-standing case in Ecuador about environmental degradation as a result of an oil well, originally Texaco, became Chevron's. It worked its way all the way up through the Ecuadorian court. The highest court in Ecuador decided that Chevron had to pay damages. And Chevron used investor state dispute settlement to challenge the decision from the highest court in Ecuador. And the decision was overturned. Now Chevron no longer has to pay damages decided by the court of this sovereign nation. So you talk about these issues, and it gets really muddy and fascinating that they, from Chevron's perspective, this court case was never fair in the first place. They were not given due process. But from an environmental standpoint or a human rights standpoint or even the standpoint of someone who is concerned about local rule and national sovereignty, what about the court system here in Ecuador? What about the people, the indigenous people who would have received a payout for the environmental damage that's in their backyards as a result of Chevron's activities there? How does this three-person tribunal that exists, that you know meets in some boardroom on the other side of the world, in this particular case it was The Hague, why should they have more control over this than the government in Ecuador or the justice system in this sovereign nation?
How has the movement and the frame of reference towards corporations as having personhood and having property rights within that context, how has that impacted the way all of this is looked at?
I think that we are in an extraordinary period right now. I think we're probably going to look back on the last 30 years of the way that we think about corporations and the way that we think about property as just a watershed. Richard Epstein, who is a major thinker in the conservative movement, in the 1970s, he came up with this idea of takings, regulatory takings. But the entire idea was that the government should pay every private citizen and every private business any time it passes a law or regulation that imposes in any way on the property of a citizen. So the obvious, if you think about that for even a second, it begins to balloon out of control, because if the government passes a law on restricting, say, the amount that you can pollute in water, then suddenly how many people are negatively affected by that in terms of their how they have to redo their wells or how they have to redo their businesses so that they're polluting less in rivers and streams. And if the government was required to pay out to every time to all of those businesses and private citizens, then it would very rapidly go broke. So this idea of regulatory takings was always the extreme sense of valuing corporations and valuing property rights over everything else, over society, community, environmental, public health, any other concern that you might have. And what we're seeing now is that this intellectual idea is being seated in these investor state dispute settlement tribunals. Where it didn't take root in the United States, several times the Supreme Court actually decided, look, you know, we're sympathetic to this takings idea, but it just can't apply. We can't have a government and honor regulatory takings. But on this international level, in these tribunals, you're really seeing these arbitrators embrace that idea and say, hey, Canada, if you want to pass a law that requires offshore drillers to contribute more to research and development, you'd better pay up. You better pay them, because you're actually expropriating what they thought would be their future profits. And that's a real case that happened just recently.
Talk about how this is being looked at in the EU, and more pushback to the very idea of investment protections, investor protections simply being taken out of some of these trade deals.
Yes, the backlash has been profound in a lot of places. And I mentioned South America before. You're seeing a lot of countries there that are actively backing out of bilateral investment treaties that include investor state dispute settlement. Europe has also been a major pushback place. And some of that is, there's kind of two camps there. There are people in Europe who think that we should just get rid of any sort of form of investor state dispute settlement whatsoever. And their argument is, why would we allow corporations to challenge our country's court systems outside, or our country's decisions outside of our country's courts, because of course, and that's an important point. So, just a side note, you know, if you're a foreign investor operating in Germany, and Germany acts in a way that you believe is unfair, you can sue the government of Germany through German courts, just like everyone else, just like a German company might be able to do that, or just like a human rights activist in Germany might be able to do. The German courts exist and are robust and respected. So it's not as if you lose all judicial channels if you don't have this tribunal, that you don't have access to this tribunal. So that's kind of the argument from one portion of these European detractors who say, you know, what is the point of this in the first place? And then you have another side, more of institutional, and you had the EU Parliament come out with a proposal that basically took aspects of investor-state dispute settlement tribunals and then institutionalized them. So put them into a situation where judges would be not appointed willy-nilly, they would be vetted, they would have longer appointments, they wouldn't just be private arbitrators, often corporate lawyers, rising up and making these decisions. They would also put in place an appellate court. So if a tribunal made a decision that that either party deeply disagreed with, there would be a mechanism that you could take that to an appeals board of some sort. So this new court, ICS is what they're calling it, is also on the table and was included in a few recent new free trade agreements, like the EU-Canada free trade agreement includes this new institutionalized version of investor-state dispute settlement.
Is there any sense of corporations actually pushing actively for this to continue? Is this something that exists because of inertia, as we talked about at the outset, or is there really corporate effort to keep this institutionalized in some way in these trade agreements? And what would be any different from a corporate perspective, from an investor perspective, if they were gone?
There is an active push. I mean, it's you have to, from a corporate perspective, they have only to gain from ISDS. They don't have to use the mechanism if they don't want to, and it provides an additional avenue of judicial remedy should they want it. So from any multinational corporation's perspective, they want ISDS, of course, and you see that happening behind the scenes in these negotiations. You see these big business groups, Business Roundtable and Chamber of Commerce, pushing for it on behalf of their clients. So that's another reason why it remains in these trade deals. If they didn't have it, if they didn't have access to it, then they would have to use the court systems of the countries where they were operating. And that puts them on the same playing field as all of the corporations that, you know, all the domestic corporations in that country that only have that avenue as well. This could be a problem from their perspective in places like China. I mean, China's always the big elephant in the room when it comes to these discussions. It says, you know, they say, well, if we're going to go operate in China, shouldn't we get extra protections? We shouldn't have to submit our disputes to some Chinese court that is going to automatically decide against a foreign corporation. And the counterargument to that is those aren't the two. The counterargument to that, there's a few, but one is that that's not the only option. When a corporation enters a country, they sign a contract. There's a contractual agreement with that country, and they can write into that contractual agreement on a private level certain dispute settlement agreements. Another is that there's foreign direct investment is risky. And this is the libertarian Cato Institute's argument, that Apple knows when it goes into China that it is taking a risk. It knows that, and it chooses to take that risk anyway. Why should the taxpayers be on the hook to subsidize those risks in the future?
If one looks at the history of the rulings from these courts, is there any pattern? Have corporations won more than the states? Have the states won more than the corporations? Has a pattern emerged in terms of how these get resolved?
That is, if you look just at every single case that's been heard, again, only the ones that we know about, you see about, it's about a 50-50 split. You see about 60% of the time they decide, the tribunals decide in favor of corporations, and 40% of the time it's in favor of governments. That's after you exclude the number of cases that have been dismissed for jurisdictional reasons and whatnot. So it does lean towards deciding in favor of corporations, but it's not, it hasn't been, it's not a 90-10 situation yet.
Haley Sweetland Edwards, her book just published by Columbia Global Reports, is Shadow Courts, the Tribunals That Rule Global Trade. Haley, thanks so much for spending time with us here today on Radio Who, What, Why.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.